you know, all the things I've gone through the travels, through different careers, there's a pain in that because, you know, you have to die to things that you thought you were, or that you assumed, the hometown you live in, the way that somebody eats with their fork, or that a particular way of learning something.
What's going on, guys? Anand here. Welcome back. And for those of you tuning in for the first time, then I welcome you to this series that explores the lives that have crossed borders and cultures on a journey of discovery and purpose. So today's guest is really the story of someone who has done some incredible life exploring and soul searching. Call it serendipity, but my guest's life has seen him on the move almost every few years since the age of 3. And through those travels and key moments in his personal life, this has really helped him to tap into his own internal journey. As he describes it, he doesn't believe he'd be able to facilitate others the way that he does now if he wasn't on a journey of self-discovery of his own. Now, one of the purposes of these conversations is to explore how my guests' journeys across borders has really helped to shape their character and drive them to a purpose of positive impact. And that is just what Taylor is committed to now. As the founder of Galleon Trainings, he guides and facilitates individuals and companies to access their intuition and creative consciousness, but not before having immersed in some very contrasting societies and learning a lot about himself along the way.
Hi, Taylor. Thanks for finding time to be on this. I've given my guests a bit of an introduction to you in the beginning so they can see why I'm quite excited to really find out more about how you evolved growing up. I mean, what I really admire about your background is that you've worked with multinational corporations, investment banks, construction enterprises, all the way to individual investors and now individuals on a path of self-development and soul searching. To kick this off, I really want to go back to the beginning and I'd love to hear about your childhood and where this all started.
Thanks, Anand. Thanks for the introduction. Really appreciate it. I had a pretty simple childhood. I grew up in a bunch of different places. My mom and I moved around several times in the first several years of my life. My parents were divorced by the time I was 2. And then for about 10 years, it was just me and my mom. I think I wanted other things, but you know, as a child, you don't really know what else is available other than what's in front of you. So, you know, I grew up in relatively suburban environments in West Virginia, Virginia, Connecticut. But I probably had moved half a dozen times within the first sort of 3 years of my life. I was born in California, and I think we spent about 3 weeks there before we drove across country because my father was stationed there during the Vietnam War. So I do remember that a number of years ago, a woman I went on a date with, she got us as an experience with like a psychic. So we went to go see this psychic together as a date experience, which was quite cool and curious.
Was it a first date?
It was a first date. Yeah.
Oh wow!
Yeah. It was in like a restaurant, like a Chinese or like fusion restaurant. I remember I had a ring that I had worn for a long time was on the middle finger of my left hand. And this woman said, do you know what that symbolizes? And I said, I don't know. It's the ring that fits in the finger I decided to put it on. And she said, it indicates somebody who travels a lot, particularly in adult life. I mean, I traveled in childhood, but also quite a bit in my adult life. So up until the time I was sort of 8, we traveled 4 or 5 states or cities. And then I've kind of been on a sort of journey and travels on and off since then, although I've been fairly stable in London for the last 15 years.
And do you think moving around quite frequently really had an influence on the way you turned out or your ability to integrate with people and societies?
I think it must have. You know, it's very hard to look back and rationally imagine who I was or what I was understanding as a two-year-old. I think the fact that there was no solid ground to where I was growing up. So, you know, I was one place from age 3 till 8, and then in another place from 8 till 18. And even when my mom and I moved to Richmond, from 8 to 18, we lived in 3 different houses. Like my neighbors, the kids that were close to me, we didn't actually go to school together. So I kind of also had this separation. There were, you know, kids I knew at school. And then there were kids that I would come home from school and play with in the afternoon. So there was always this kind of separation that I felt. And I'm sure on some level it taught me adaptability. It probably also, in a detrimental way, sort of taught me that I'm always sort of looking for something else, right? That because there wasn't a kind of, you know, foundation of what we're, you know, some people, they're born in a house and they spend their entire childhood there, and they go back and their parents are still living in that house. And that obviously would create sort of a psychological, emotional foundation. And yeah, I'd probably had lived in 10 or 12 different homes by the time I'd graduated high school.
Yeah, there's an interesting point that you touch on. Do you think that there was any element of fear of getting too close to people such as friends because of the programming that you may end up moving again sometime soon?
Yeah, definitely. And I think in a way, even when I, you know, I can look back on what I started to do as I moved into my own adult life and had choice for myself. When I left high school, I went to a university that nobody from my high school had ever gone to. Not that it was particularly that far away or that exotic. It just was something that I don't think anybody had ever gone to. And so I think there was a bit of, you know, me kind of trying to be a bit of a loner, do things differently. You know, I had a bit of a sort of quirky, rebellious kind of attitude in my teens and into my 20s. And, you know, certainly in my 20s, I moved around quite a bit. I drove across the country, I drove across the U.S. and lived someplace else, moved back to the East Coast, lived in a few different states. What I noticed, as you say, was there, whether I was aware of it or not, I probably wasn't particularly comfortable with just putting my roots down in any one place. Yeah. And so I traveled around a lot. I moved to a lot of different places, and I might stay someplace for a year or 4 years. In fact, when I, after I'd lived here for 5 years and lived in the same place, the same apartment, and I looked back and counted all of the homes or, you know, temporary homes, like over the summer or whatever it was that I'd lived in, it was something like, I don't know, 35 or something in 35 years or something like that. You know, I mean, some of the, like in university, you might live in a dorm and then another place during the summer or something. But I, you know, I counted all of those and I realized that the longest I'd live in any one abode was the apartment I was living in here. And that was after, and that was 5 years. And I've actually stayed in the same apartment now for 15 years. I own it now. I've renovated it. And I think that there came a realization that maybe it was time to sort of stop the running and to, you know, to really make an effort to settle down emotionally, psychologically, and physically as well. Although I say that, and I'm actually thinking about leaving London and the UK.
Yeah, no, I was going to ask off that, when you had that sense of, okay, maybe it's time to stop the running, was that a natural feeling or thought process that occurred, or did you kind of impose that on yourself that you told yourself, now I should be doing this?
It was not a should. It was an awareness or realization that, you know, I think that when I was in my sort of 20s and 30s, I was running away from things I was running two things, right? I thought I was running two things, but the realization after a while was that I was running away from things. But, you know, like, I don't know, the saying goes, like, wherever you go, there you are, right? And so you can't really run away from yourself.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. It takes a few decades to get there. At least for me, I'm a bit dim sometimes. And yeah, like I had been upset or, you know, depressed and not happy with particular things. And I had, you know, assumed maybe because, I hadn't really thought about this, but maybe because my mom and I moved around, and obviously that's imposed upon me, you know, as a 1-year-old or 2-year-old or 8-year-old, you don't have a lot of choice in that. And so I think as I, you know, grew up and had adult choices, I probably, yeah, thought that I, wherever I was, I would be unhappy. And unhappiness. And so I would think, okay, well, this place, right? You can always point out things that are bad or dysfunctional or, you know, the weather.
Some kind of flaw, yeah.
Yeah. When I traveled enough places and realized, well, maybe it's not the place. Maybe it's maybe it's the person that's traveling through the places. You know, and I think that was one of the things that really started me seriously on my journey of self-discovery, self-awareness. You know, as you said, that's what I've moved into for not only for myself, but as a career. You know, I really started to look at, well, you know, what's the constant here?
And just before we go into that, let's quickly jump into the rebellious phase that you mentioned. Are there any particular standout memories that you have from that phase?
The hometown I grew up in, you know, I was looking at, you know, some of your questions that you had, and I was thinking about the hometown that I grew up in, and particularly the school I went to, because I started there at age 8, which was, you know, third grade. I don't know what the equivalent here is. In a way, I was, you know, new to that school, and it was a private school. It was a small school, and Richmond, Virginia, it's not so much anymore, but it has a very aristocratic pass to it, in the sense that if, you know, you belong, if you were born there and your father was born there and your grandfather was born there. So there are a lot of people, you know, and I don't think it's as popular here in the UK, but in the US, people will be named, you know, the same name, right? So you're William Randolph Johnson the third or something, or the fourth, right? And this lineage kind of follows you down. And it had that aspect at the school I went to as well. So the fact that I didn't start there from age 5, that I had moved into that at a, you know, even only at the age of 8, I was an outsider. And so there was a, you know, and I kind of kept that label throughout my, you know, adolescence and into teenage years. So at some point I just kind of adopted that and said, okay, well, fine, I'll just be an outsider, right? If I'm being labeled an outsider, then let me choose to be an outsider. So it wasn't anything, I mean, I wasn't very, I wasn't malevolent or like destructive. I just kind of, you know, wore different clothing, listened to different music, you know, colored my hair blue or shaved it or did weird things to just kind of stand out. You know, I mean, there wasn't a lot of, I look at it now, it's rather naive rebellion, in terms of just trying to stand out and trying to create my own identity, because there was probably a pain in not being, you know, one of the kind of in kids or cool kids or, you know, accepted, kind of crowd. But that also made me who I am, right? I mean, I learned to really appreciate the uniqueness of whatever I liked and, yeah, what I gravitated towards.
Yeah, one of my really biggest sources of inspiration, he often says this statement, which is based on identifying with yourself. And he says that, I'm not who I think I am. I'm not who you think I am. I'm who I think you think I am. Do you think that played into why you felt as an outsider, that maybe sometimes it did come from a place of you just thought that's how they perceived you?
Absolutely. And, you know, as a teenager, right, everything, you know, it's like nobody knows anything, right? Everything's projection.
Yeah.
And I mean, I wasn't particularly athletic. I wasn't on any of the school kind of teams, and definitely rather nervous around girls. And so, yeah, I had an assumption, right? And I, you know, I was very, because I grew up as an only child, I spent a lot of time in my own head. And so my understanding of the world was based on my assumption of things. And yes, if somebody, you know, kids may have kept their distance because they were intimidated and thought, oh, I don't know how to deal with this person. But I may have interpreted that as, oh, I'm weird or I'm not acceptable or anything like that. So I think that that's true. And I didn't really feel that. I mean, there was a sort of a soft pain in that, but it wasn't like, you know, some people can get really, really depressed and, right, you know, go into themselves. And I think, I don't know, maybe the connection I had with my mother, or, you know, the sort of distant connection I had with my father, you know, they're both very interesting characters, and I see myself, or I see both of them in me, in very, very different ways. So I, relatively early on, and, you know, I also gravitated towards a group of friends where we were kind of the outsiders. There was solidarity in being sort of the outside group, to the extent that there were one or two people that were kind of in the in crowd, that by 16 or 17, they were kind of coming and saying, "Ooh, can we hang out with you?"
Yeah. Almost that we're the same in that we're different.
Yeah. Because there was a solidarity in our sort of clique, subgenre of weirdness, which was just that we didn't really fit in, and we weren't that concerned. I think music, you know, was probably the thing that differentiated us the most. Mm. You know, we were into sort of independent alternative, what we call, like, back then was college music, because there were commercial radio stations that, you know, would play throughout the city and have advertisements on them, but at sort of the left end of the dial, you'd have college radio stations that might only have like a 5-mile radius. And, you know, in the US, when you're driving around, you might only catch a portion of a radio station for, you know, half an hour as you're driving through. And, you know, it's people that are just a couple of years older than you that are just speaking into a microphone and just playing random stuff, not because they're being paid or because the, you know, record companies telling them to do it. But, and so there was a real symbol of that we connected with them. And I spent 4 years at my university being a radio DJ, because it became a symbol of my independence, of my sort of forging out on my own, of my, you know, curiosity for finding new things.
Yeah.
Which I think, you know, we kind of talked about in the beginning, was kind of there. And it's kind of stayed with me.
Yeah, that's actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, because from what I understand, you began your life as a commercial lawyer.
No, actually, that was probably, I mean, I was 30 when I started. So I had gone through other iterations. I tried to make some films. I wasn't very good at it. I worked as an apprentice blacksmith and metal sculptor for a couple of years. So I'd kind of gone through a number of sort of journeys.
Yeah.
And I went to law school and actually had no intention of being a commercial corporate lawyer. I thought it was going to be something very, very different. One summer, one of my best friends from law school was working in New York City. And I went to visit him one weekend and had one of the most fun and amazing times in my life. And I said, "Oh, how do I get here?"
Okay.
And he kind of coached me through that. And I worked my butt off and then got a job in New York. And that kind of started a different journey. So,
yeah, because I was going to ask if it was something you always knew you wanted to do or you fell into it, but that explains it quite well. But one thing I noticed with that is you did focus on renewable energy projects. And so it seems to me that your mindset was always driven by this idea of sustainability and creating a better future for people.
Well, that also kind of happened quite by chance. So I didn't really know, when I worked as a corporate lawyer, I didn't know much about renewable energy or sustainability. Mm. I think one thing that did happen that opened my eyes a bit at the time, the girlfriend I had in law school was lactose intolerant. And So she introduced me, I mean, this is, you know, sort of mid to late 90s, she introduced me to soy milk, rice milk, and I had no idea what these things were. I got to a point where I actually started to appreciate them, and I started to look at, you know, things like what was actually happening. I mean, it coincided in the US, you know, I know here there was a foot and mouth disease. And in the US, we had where like the milk, there were a lot of hormones that were being put into cows that were kind of having, you know, deleterious effects on consumers because they were getting, you know, like all these sick cows were having to be fed all these hormones to be able to produce viable milk. And and I actually remember at the time, I never really liked milk that much. Like, I mean, I drank it a lot as a kid, and when I was an adult, I kind of kept at it, but I didn't really like it.
To be honest, me neither.
Yeah. I liked ice cream, but I didn't really like milk.
Well, something that I heard a few months ago, which some people say that they knew this already, but I found it quite fascinating that actually as human beings and very similar to other mammals, our body is not designed to take in milk and dairy after a certain point, right? It's very much in the early years where we get it from our mother through natural sources. But at one point, we are meant to shift away from having such a dairy intake. And I think it was, I'm tempted to say the Europeans who, you know, they saw the ostentatiousness of having milks and cheeses and feta and all these fancy types of dairy that it then became more prevalent in diets. But again, you know, generations back, it wasn't meant to be eating, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, certainly personally for me, like I've definitely cut a lot of dairy out. I used to have much more. And if I have much, I sort of notice, you know, my, you know, sort of become a bit bloated or my mucus or whatever. That kind of moved me into looking, for instance, at diet, which moved me into looking at, well, what is it that we have as a society? This was at a time when we were first starting to become aware, where there was public awareness, discussion about, you know, the factory farming. And I was a bit horrified by a lot of that. So I started to move into, and I, you know, spent a number of years as well a pescatarian. And when I moved to Japan, because there's a lot of access to fish there and it's in the diet, I ate a lot of fish. But you know, I was kind of aware of things, but I didn't necessarily plan to move into renewable energy. You know, when as a corporate lawyer, I worked in New York, Tokyo, and then here in London. And it's when I moved here to London that I only knew one person. He got me into all sorts of different things. So he introduced me to permaculture, and he told me what he was doing, which was starting to develop offshore wind farms. I'd never heard anything about it. I had no idea what it was. It was this sort of fantastical, otherworldly concept. Yeah. And he told me about it. And I remember at the time saying, that's amazing. How do I get involved in that? And he said, well, stay in touch. We're growing and we need people. And I don't know, probably a year and a half, maybe two years later, we were working together.
So permaculture, you mentioned, that's definitely something I want to get more into and ask you about. But before that, you talked about your move to Japan. Let's get into that. So what was the build up to that? What led to you deciding to make that move? Because I assume that was your first real transition to a completely new environment.
Yeah, it was, although I had done some travel. After university, I drove across the US. I packed up my car with a bunch of things and two friends of mine got in the car with me, and we spent 5 weeks driving across the US. And I had kind of done the, when you graduated university, people would go backpacking around Europe, right? So you'd get a Eurorail pass and kind of just go from city to city or place to place. And I'd done that with a friend of mine. And my father had a travel bug in him. Although my parents are divorced, I developed a, you know, pretty good relationship with him. And something in what he spoke about really spoke to me. And so I felt a real desire to get out and explore. So I explored quite a bit of the US and lived in different places. When I graduated from law school, before I started working in New York, I took 5 months and just went on my own to South Central and South America. Okay. And so that was probably the biggest challenge that I'd faced at that time, because I learned Spanish. I didn't really know what I was doing or where I was going. I just, you know, had a couple of Lonely Planet guidebooks, yeah, a backpack. I was still using film camera, right? You know, I mean, we didn't even have digital cameras. Maybe there were, but I didn't have one. I'd sort of check in, go to an internet cafe and check in with email every week or so to tell my mom I was still alive, and that was about it.
I guess there's no Google Maps to...
No, there was, nobody had cell phones. Yeah. And so that really opened me up to, really gave me the travel bug. Like, I really loved the exploring and the travel and the adventure. And when I started working in New York, I mean, I had a great experience working in New York, and a very good friend of mine who I had met, she said, look, obviously you're being paid very well. You know, you're working as a corporate lawyer. And I was being paid very well, like far more than I thought I was worth from having done manual labor and all sorts of other things. But anyway, I wasn't going to say no to a paycheck. And she said to me, she said, don't ever forget that although they're paying you well, they are still leveraging you. Mm. Not to say there's anything wrong with the paycheck, but what else? But, you know, she really pressed me and said, what else do you want to get out of this experience? And it was really, really helpful advice, because I love living in New York, but I think I knew relatively early on that I didn't want to live in New York. Mm. There were things that were amazing. I mean, it was a fantastic place to live, and there was so much going on, but there was something about it that was almost too urban for me. I can't really identify, but it just didn't quite fit with what I wanted. And I knew I think maybe because I'd come out of traveling to Central and Latin America, that I wanted to go out and explore. And so I had actually studied in Japanese history and studies when I was in university. There was something about sort of the Japanese way, the culture, the history, that really intrigued me. So there was that sort of thing that was inside of me that I had remembered. And when I looked around at the law firm I was working for, in particular, the Asian offices appealed to me, because I'd never been to Asia. And I knew that there would be a level of support working for an American company or a law firm, and there would be this, you know, massive challenge and exotic way of being and living. So I said, yeah, I want to go to Japan. I went to the human resources department after the first year, and I said, I'd like to go to the Japanese office, the Tokyo office. And the woman in HR said, well, okay, that's great, but we usually only send people that are more senior than you, that have, you know, 2 or 3 years experience, or if they're junior, they can speak Japanese, and you don't have either of those. So thank you, but no. But I put my, you know, hand up in the air, and about 6 months later, I got a call from human resources, and they said, oh, we need a junior lawyer to move to Tokyo.
Oh, amazing.
And so that sort of set the ball in motion. And I said, when do I leave? I was on a plane 3 weeks after 9/11 from New York, flying to Tokyo.
That's incredible. And I think, yeah, there's a particular interest in that for me, because I moved from the UK to China, and it was a move fueled out of curiosity to immerse in a new environment altogether, in a new culture, and just chase something that I felt I didn't have back home, and just a curiosity that I've also had the travel bug. But I want to really live abroad. And if I'm going to do that, I'm going to go somewhere that is quite different, but also on the cusp of prospering and reaching heights that it's never been to before. So, you know, what was it like when you first arrived there, in terms of, was it different to your expectations? how was it to integrate with the society there?
I don't know what my expectations were, but I do remember very well, because I knew absolutely nobody, that when the plane landed in at Narita International Airport, I remember the plane landing, and I just remember thinking, oh my God, what have I done? This, maybe this was a massive mistake. Can I just stay on this plane?
Right.
And I'll just fly back to New York and everything will be back to normal. But obviously I knew that that wasn't. And yeah, the first month or so, it was this curious mix, because on the one hand, I had no idea what I was doing. I'd taken a couple classes. I spoke very little Japanese. It's one thing to be able to speak and say, hello, how are you? Which way to the news agent, or, you know, something very simple. But reading the language is incredibly difficult.
Oh, yeah.
Chinese character, I mean, sure, that you had the same problem. So there was something very intimidating about that. And yet Japan is one of, if not the safest place that I've ever been to.
Yeah.
You know, there were vending machines on the street that sold cigarettes and alcohol. And they just kind of knew that if you were under whatever 18, you wouldn't use
those.
You wouldn't
use it. Yeah.
So that was quite sort of unique. And I think that there was definitely a mix that I felt. I lived there for 2 years, and there was a real mix of what it was like, because on the one hand, as a white Western American male, there's a lot of post-war Japan adopted a lot of American culture.
Okay. Tastes.
You know, both in the sort of personal society, like jeans and Coca-Cola and you know, all of that, but also on the business side as well. So right. Had a very American essence to it. So there was this kind of reverence and deference, maybe not reverence, but certainly a deference to American culture, American business culture. And so as a representative of that, I was working as a corporate lawyer, right? So wearing a suit, walking around as a, you know, I mean, like I'm the luck of the draw, which maybe the tide's turning, but like I'm an incredibly fortunate person that just as it happened, right? I was born as a white male in the late 20th century. Now, that doesn't mean anything, you know, like it gave me a lot of innate, you know, probably bias to certain things. You know, I've said to friends of mine, it's like, well, if I were born 100 years earlier or later, things would be very, very different. You know, 100 years ago, I would have been in a trench in France, you know, like having mustard gas like dumped on me. And maybe in 100 years I'll be, you know, it doesn't look like the American project is going that well. I'm not sure we'll be at the top of the charts in another 100 years. And you know, and so power shifts, right? But certainly being in Japan at that time,
there were almost favorable prejudices that you held.
Well, there's two things. Yeah, so there is that kind of favorable prejudice because it's so exotic, right? I mean, Japan's one of the most ethnically sort of uniform countries, where I'm sure something like 99%, close to probably 99% of the population, is Japanese.
Yeah.
And so there are even, you know, not to get into it that much, but you know, there's prejudice against Koreans or Chinese or, you know, Taiwanese or, you know, whomever else that is Asian but not Japanese.
Yeah.
So obviously I stick out, right? There's no way I'm going to pass for Japanese. And so there was this other side that although I had a lot, I could, you know, there's a lot of deference to my exotic nature. There was also an essence of like, well, clearly I'm not going to fit in. And being in Japan, there were elements of not quite fitting in, whether it's the language, whether it's the attitude. There were a couple of places I went to that, you know, I was refused entry to. Wow. And I didn't, I mean, I sort of thought it was curious, but I didn't really take that much offense. I thought, well, that's cool. That's their society. Who am I to tell them how to conduct it?
And do you think that's because you are a non-Asian or a non-Japanese?
Non-Japanese.
Right. And why do you think that is or was their mentality then? Do you think it was an innate patriotic feeling to Japan, or it was just because there was a difference in, you know, the way of living even compared to other Asian nations?
You know, I think every nation, right, because we have this concept of nation states, right, and we have borders and this concept, it's like, oh, you are, you know, even here, right, it's like, oh, you're from South London, oh, you're from North London, yeah. Right, it creates an identity.
Sure.
And there is a, you know, there's a legitimacy to that, there's a legitimate side to that, and there's a dysfunctional side to that, right, because once you put the label onto somebody, then you cut off seeing who they are as a person, right? It's like, oh, you are a man, or you're white, or you're South Korea, you know, whatever it is that becomes the label, right? There's a functional side of like, oh, wow, that makes you distinct, right? Like, let's understand what that cultural distinction yeah. is. Like, I'm not familiar with that, right? But it also can tip to the other side of, oh, I'm going to, you know, shut something off. And I think we all have that to a certain extent.
This prejudgment, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I grew up with biases. I mean, I try to break them down. I try to become aware of them and say, oh, okay, well, is this a bias, or is the reason I, you know, have, you know, an affinity or or, you know, an aversion to somebody?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I mean, like I said, I'm who am I to say, tell the Japanese how to conduct Japanese society.
Sure, yeah.
But you know, I had friends who were married to, you know, either Japanese man or Japanese woman, had lived there. They were going to live there, and you know, they spoke fluent Japanese. They could fit in to a certain extent, but they would never be considered Japanese.
Mm.
You know, and I, you know, it's their different countries have different ways of socializing.
No, absolutely. And did you find it gradually became any easier to integrate with them, either socially or professionally?
Well, I mean, my language got better.
Yeah.
And I just figured out, you know, you figure out ways that are, you kind of follow the path of least resistance, right? So I'm not going to go try to make friends with the Yakuza.
Yeah.
You know, like it's not a very open society, right? Where, and you know, I think the majority, in fact, probably almost all of the friends I had lived outside of Japan. So okay. Even people who might speak English but had lived their whole life in Japan struggled to connect with me, or maybe I struggled to connect with them. Even the Japanese friends I had been expats themselves, so they understood it.
No, I think you touch on a point that I can fully relate to, even in my time in China, and I'm talking about being there in 2018. It very much was a case of struggling to connect. So there wasn't really a intent behind, I don't want to be able to interact with this person on a personal level, but just the case of, you know, we've grown up so differently. Our understandings and family life and cultures are so different that there's only going to be a certain level that we connect on. And I think that's what also drives a lot of business there between, let's call them foreigners versus the locals, that they go for dinner and then they drink. And it's, you know, two things that people can happily connect on, food and drink. And then through there, you build a connection, knowing that it probably doesn't stem deeper than that, but at least there's that mutual understanding there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's really interesting to hear your experience. Thus is the struggle of you know, what it means to be human and how to learn to connect, because you either choose to be open to a connection. You know, we can have a pretty open discussion on a podcast, but if we chose to really get to know each other, right, we might find there would be a time, whether because it's age or, you know, how we grew up or something, that we really, wow, you know, we really come up against it. And does that then mean that we're incompatible as friends, or is it an opportunity to learn more about
oneself
and the person, you know, because at the end of the day, we're all just human, right?
Right. Yeah.
And we have fears, we have unknowns, we're perfectly imperfect. And that's, and to me, that's the beauty of it, right?
Absolutely.
That's what connects us all in a way, right? There's so many differences on the outset, but when you boil down to the inner self, something inside it connects us all in that we are the same species.
Mm. And, you know, like I was just thinking, you know, I'm mindful because Americans kind of always get a bit of a bad rap and in some ways, rightfully so, right? I think something only like a third of Americans have a passport, something like
right.
that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a few different reasons for that. One, it's a very large country, so you can do a lot of traveling and a lot of diverse places without having to leave your country. Most people only have 2 weeks vacation, maybe up to 3 weeks, right? And so they don't necessarily think to go someplace else. And there is an element, you know, it's an isolated country.
Yeah,
Canada to the north is very similar in a lot of ways, although not obviously the same. And, you know, Mexico only touches 2, 3, or 4 states, right? So there's not a lot of, you know, certainly in Texas and Arizona and New Mexico and California, Southern California, there's a lot of Hispanic culture that kind of comes in Florida as well. You know, here, right, in the UK, it's like, you know, a lot of people I know, it's like, oh, yeah, we were going to Greece as kids. We went to Spain. We went skiing or, you know, people were just traveling around. There's a lot of kind of cross exploration.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, things like, you know, Champions League, right? Even that, right? Because then it's like, oh, well, I'm going to go support Bayern Munich when they're playing Liverpool or, you know, whomever, right? That you're seeing something, you're interacting on many, many different levels. The European Union and trade and, you know, you've also got hundreds or close to thousands of years of connection.
You're right. You know, as a kid, you're coming from this part of the world, we are indirectly, not even indirectly, but exposed to these cultures. I mean, going on holiday as a child, you know, you probably only have certain interests, like trying gelato in Italy because it's ice cream and, you know, which kid doesn't like ice cream? But then from everything, you just being in that country and it being different to back home, you are being exposed to these cross-cultural differences. You're right. Yeah.
And I think in the U.S., you know, I mean, talking to friends or family, because there's an unknown, right? And if you're not necessarily exposed to that early on, right, it can seem quite intimidating. You know, there's language, there's culture. Well, I don't know how things work. People are driving on the different side of the road or there's signs that I can't read. You know, if you come across that at sort of in 25 or 30 for the first time.
Yeah.
It can, you know, it's very intimidating, right? And so it can be easier just to kind of throw up a barrier to choose to not understand because it's easier, it's safer. But when you open up, when you just allow that to be, and see the other person as a human being, then there's a real opportunity for discovery, connection, fun, you know, like exploration, right? To see what it is that what's different and what's similar.
And so what came next? How long were you in Japan for?
I was there for 2 years.
Okay.
And I moved here for a year. And then I left the law, got married, moved to the south of France with a French woman. That didn't last terribly long, the marriage or my time in France. I was there for about close to 2 years, a year and a half, 2 years. And when I was getting a divorce, I really had no idea what I was going to do. But there wasn't anything holding me or calling to me in the south of France. I had a relationship that was ending. Most of the friends I had were my ex-wife's.
How did you find it adapting and integrating into life in south of France, especially comparing to going from the US to Japan?
So there were definitely similarities and there were differences. So in Tokyo, the vast majority of my friends were expats. I spoke English. You know, I definitely tried to practice and use Japanese, but partly because of my job, right? My job was all in English. And so I would be communicating in English. Even if I could understand some of what they were saying, that work was not in Japanese.
Yeah.
But the vast majority of conversations, overwhelming majority of conversations, were in English. Whereas in France, that was very different. Particularly in this, I mean, France is kind of known for that, right? And that's fine, right? I mean, it's their language, right? And so I had a different sort of socialization. It wasn't that I didn't look like I fit in, but I definitely sounded like I didn't fit in.
Yeah.
And when you get thrown in conversation with a bunch of young adults who are throwing slang around very, very quickly between each other, it's being thrown in the deep end of something that was quite challenging. And then again, I mean, France is a beautiful country. Fantastic quality of life. South of France is beautiful. It's, you know, sort of known about 300 days of sunshine a year. But it was very challenging to find work, particularly as an expat. And, you know, when the marriage fell apart, as I said, I didn't have any overwhelming call to stay there. So I was sort of searching around where to. I was kind of licking my wounds over the breakup of the marriage. And my friend, who I'd mentioned was the only person I knew here in London, called me up and said, "Oh, do you remember Chris, who does work on offshore wind farms? I think he's looking for somebody." And so serendipity, grace, the hand of God or spirit or somehow the universe said, "Well, here's an opportunity. What do you think about this, Taylor?" And I just leapt at it. It was what I wanted to do. I wanted to move into something different. I wanted to transition away from my legal background, but use it, leverage it. And so, so I threw everything I had into this one job interview. From the time I actually found out about it until the time I started, I think it took 5 months.
Okay.
For all sorts of reasons, like because I'm American and wasn't European, at the end of the day, I was the best candidate they found, but then they had to go through putting something in European newspapers to say, "Well, we're looking for somebody." I had to go through all those kind of legal hoops. Took 5 months. So it was somewhat a stressful time, but I was just singularly focused on getting that job.
Yeah. It's very similar to a story that I have around the role I'm in now, which took also 5 months, right? It's funny because mine happened during a time when, you know, we were going into a lockdown and no one knew where the economy was going. So it was almost, it wasn't expected, but people weren't as surprised to hear that the process was that long because they understood these external factors. But back then when it happened, was that quite a long stretch to be holding out for something like this?
Yeah. I kind of had no idea what else I was going to do.
Right.
I mean, yeah, sometimes I can be very myopic and short-sighted in terms of what I think is possible.
Right.
The divorce I had was very challenging for me, and I had, it coincided with a lot of different things. As I'd moved from the US to Japan to the UK and into France. It felt very much like that was over. So there was a part of me that felt that was a failure on many levels, failure personally, failure professionally. I had gone from, you know, a high paying, high profile career that I wasn't particularly happy with, and I'd left and I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. So there was a lot of soul searching and thinking, well, what am I supposed to be doing, and you know, the sort of tension that goes along with that. It coincided, I mentioned earlier, my father had died when I was in my last year of law school. He had been a lawyer, but he had followed a very, very different career, and in a way that was an inspiration, because when I decided, I said, you know, I'd done a few other things, when I decided to go to law school, I went to law school because it gave me flexibility to do other things. And because he died quite suddenly, I hadn't really gone through a grieving process.
Right.
And it was actually when I was in France that I just broke down, because I had you know, the kind of thing where your father, you know, helps you kind of validate what you're doing in your life, right? Mm. I all of a sudden I left this career that he had helped me bring about, and I had left it, and then he was gone. He'd been dead, you know, 5 years at that point, and all of that weight just kind of came crashing in on me. So there was a lot sort of wrapped up in it, and you know, I don't know what would have happened if I hadn't gotten that job, but that's what I did. I put everything I had. It was very challenging to transition because lawyering, you learn that you're very good at certain things, but you don't necessarily think that you're very good at other things.
Right.
Abstracting what I was actually good at, you know, listening, being objective, synthesizing, they weren't apparent, right? Because I had worked on initial public offerings or mergers and acquisitions. So I knew this specific way to draft a contract or what this type of, you know, you get very into, you go down rabbit holes. It's like what specifically is in the wording of this clause. It was a challenge for me to abstract that and say, well, what is this really about?
And do you think this path of self-discovery that you almost went on has really helped you to frame what you're doing now because you've kind of been through it yourself?
Yeah. I don't believe I would be able to do what I do and facilitate other people's journeys if I were not on a journey myself. And I enjoy it. You know, all the things I've gone through the travels, through different careers, there's a pain in that because, you know, you have to die to things that you thought you were or that you assumed, the hometown you live in, the way that somebody eats with their fork, or that a particular way of learning something. And dying to that to create something else, like I've settled down here in London, you know, my travels have become less about where I need to go out in the world to explore something because I have to find something that I don't feel complete on. So those travels have gone into more internal journeys to find that, you know, it's a spiritual quest, right? If you look at every spiritual tradition, you don't go outside. The truth is in you, you know, the gold, the love, it's already in you. Right. But we've forgotten that. The travels I've been on externally have guided me and helped me navigate better my own internal journey, which is still ongoing. Like I haven't arrived anywhere. Like, you know, I'm still journeying, and hopefully long may it continue, to uncover and discover more gold, more opportunity, more awareness. And I'd like to guide, facilitate and support others in that.
And tell me how that journey led you to the founder of the Inner Energy Circle.
I was, I don't know. it was a connection I made to somebody in a permaculture course who offered for me to go to a talk one night at a church here in London. And here was this amazing, very small woman from Australia who had the most piercing ability to see beyond all the masks that we wear. So I started doing work with her, and went on my own discovery of my inner knowing, my intuition. And, you know, I was really fortunate. Like I was blessed to, I don't know why, maybe I recognized it. I don't know. There have been incredible mentors and gracious, generous guides who have helped me all along my path.
And do you think that journey of self-discovery and inner meaning that you talk about, does it have an end goal? And if so, what is it?
No, I like there's all these cliche things, right? It's not the destination, it's the journey.
Right.
And that mentor, Marianne Madden, I mean, what she said, which is a similar way of saying it, is life is a journey with multiple destinations. So, you know, you choose the destinations.
Yeah.
Because so it's always discovery, right? I mean, we had no idea where this conversation was going to go. We had a plan.
Yeah.
I don't know if we stuck to it, but we went on a journey.
An explorative mission, yeah.
Exactly. And it's been fun, right? I've certainly enjoyed it.
It's amazing. And I think something I really like about that quote that you said about life being a journey with multiple destinations, that there's always an opportunity to change that direction. Mm. Once you've reached, it's not like once you've chosen a certain path, you'll have to head for that destination. If along the route you end up in one of those destinations and feel like actually there is a chance to switch it and move towards a new life path or purpose.
We have choice. We have choice in our mind. We have choice in our actions. There may be external circumstances that influence that, but ultimately the choice is ours.
Yeah. I did want to cover one more thing, which I've seen that you have adopted a 30-day challenge. It's funny because last year, at the beginning of 2020, I started the same thing. And for me, it was very much, you know, there were some run-of-the-mill things that I just always wanted to learn. And then moving into some of the more, I say, you know, integratable, life-changing habits. So around frequent meditation and using that to really see a development in my ability to manage my stress better, manage my time, mind control, etc. And I saw that you did the Wim Hof breathing. So how was that?
It was cool. You know, I work as an intuitive coach, so things come to me intuitively and I choose to follow them, to take action on them, or I don't if I feel that they're true. And you know, I wrote a post about this, so maybe you read that, right? That at the end of every year, I do what I call a completion exercise to kind of, you know, put the last year into context, right? What did I create? What did I learn? And all of that then informs what I choose to create going forward. And I think the thing that I found, I mean, is that it was as much to go through it. Like, I mean, I actually am still doing that breathing. So I do it every morning, but it was also, it's just to say, well, you know, I can do anything for 30 days and I don't know whether the thing I choose I'm going to do for the rest of my life. It's not necessarily to do that. It's to go through something to decide, okay, well, what did I get from that? So I do a completion after each one. What did I create? What did I learn? What do I want to let go of? And what am I going to create next? And yeah, like I guess it's a, you know, mindfulness focus, and see where I am at the end of the 30 days. Not that I have to follow it. And, you know, I remember like day 31, I kind of woke up and I thought, well, I could just not do this. Like I've done the 30 days, but I kind of want to. Like it feels odd if I didn't, right? And, you know, they're like any practice, there's a challenge, right? To show up and do something day after day, because as soon as you take one day off, you're on a slippery slope to just never doing it again, or, you know, forgetting about it. And 6 months later, you say, oh yeah, what about that thing I used to do?
No, that's powerful. And I noticed the same thing, that it takes a lot longer to form a habit than it does to break one.
Mm.
But once you've really managed to integrate and you start appreciating the process of what you're going through, then you start to notice the subtle benefits that it has. So, and do you already know the next few that you plan to do, or is it very much?
I'll feel into it, but as I say, like I'll do a completion and I let that intuitively tell me. So one of the things about intuition is that it's about connecting to what's true inside. I mean, intuition is literally your inner tuition, your inner knowing. So I may think, you know, I may have come up with something and say, okay, yeah, it's going to be this, going to be this. Yep. But the way I practice intuition, there's an aspect of just literally emptying myself out. And so when I let go of the need to know something, so on day 30, right, I go through my exercise. And then I say, okay, what am I going to create next, right? I let go of the need to know. Now, if I come to that same thing from a place of emptiness, of not needing to know and just sort of tuning into that, but then I assume it's true. Like, so I follow then, but sometimes I might get something completely different. So, you know, as I said, you know, I don't remember how or when, but certainly after the, when I did my completion, you know, it was clear to me that I, you know, I was going to take 30 days just to write 500 words a day.
Mm.
And there have been days when it'll be 11:40 at night and I'll think, oh my God, I haven't written anything. Oh, I could just wait. And I say, no. And you know, it actually only doesn't take much more than about 15 minutes to crank out 500 words. I was talking to a friend of mine who is holding me to account to this. And I said something to him. I said, oh yeah, but you know, I'm not really very happy with what I'm writing. And, you know, I couldn't turn it into a blog post. It's just rambling. I don't feel very good about it. And it was just a beautiful reflection. He said, well, hold on a sec. When you said you were going to do this, did you say you were publishing 500 words a day or just writing?
Right.
Like, let's go back to what you said. What you said was that you were just going to write 500 words a day. So that's just doing it. It's not what you're doing. It's the act of doing it.
That, yeah.
You know, it's like you say, like to create the habit.
Yeah. I think that's really powerful, kind of having that reference point to always remember the why you set that in the first place.
Mm.
So having that accountability, I think that's incredibly powerful. And just one final point on that. I know intuition plays a lot into your teachings and even what you speak about in your podcast. You know, they often say that intuition is knowing without knowing.
Yeah.
The question I have for you is, do you feel intuition is something that can be taught or trained in someone?
Well, it does. It is individual. So I believe everybody has intuition, and I believe everybody can be taught tools and techniques to access their intuition, to develop and strengthen their intuition. I believe that our education and societal structures have a lot to answer for, because they teach people how to look outside for answers. And there may be some reason for people in power to want to do that. And when I work with people, I help guide them and facilitate and support them in developing and strengthening their, because it's inner knowing.
Yeah.
You know, I believe that it is a part of being human. I can't prove that. And what I see is that when I follow my intuition, and when my clients or my friends who do this work follow their intuition and take action on what is true for them, like soul, heart, purpose, it often has no rhyme or reason, but it opens up the path of fulfillment and self-awareness and self-determination. And
is there anything more specific you want to mention on what specifically you are working on within that space currently?
Just helping people to, I work with individuals. I do men's work, helping around creative purpose. And creative has a sort of unknown, sort of mystical, misty quality. And having spent many years as a lawyer and being very rational and logical, there's a time and place for that. And there's a time and place for being in the unknown and seeing what comes from possibility.
I mean, I've been following some of it, and it's really insightful to hear the sort of personal accounts of what has influenced you and the experiences you've been through that really contributes to that. So yeah, thank you so much for sharing all those bits.
Thank you, Anant.
Just to finish off, we'll go with the quick fire five. So
let's do it.
Question one, what was your favorite book growing up?
I think The Little Prince by Antoine Saint-Exupéry. It's all about possibility, creativity, and following your heart.
And when did you read that? How old were you?
I don't know. My mother gave it to me, and I read it probably from age 7 or 8 onwards. And I really related to The Little Prince.
And for question two, I'll give you a choice. So either based on your time in Japan or south of France, How would you describe either that period of your life or that experience in three words?
Okay, well, I'll take Japan. So it was exciting, otherworldly, and delicious.
Oh, those are good. And thirdly, what was the biggest risk you ever took, and was it worth it?
The biggest risk? Probably moving to Japan, and absolutely it was worth it.
And looking back, if you could have moved somewhere else in the world, would you have decided to go somewhere else now?
Sure. Looking back?
Do you know where that would have been?
My mom studied French and had wanted to be a translator for the UN, although she went radically different way. And I don't know, maybe we would have moved to France.
Yeah. Question five, what one message would you give to the future leaders of the world?
I would say you have two eyes, two ears, and one mouth. Use them in that proportion.
Oh, wow. I've never heard that before. That's amazing. And a bonus question that I like to ask everyone, what does the term immigrant represent for you?
Newness, uncertainty, and possibility.
Wow, yeah, that's very positive. I like that. Well, thank you so much. That
thank
does
you
come
and
to a very, very nice conclusion and a very nice positive sentiment to end on.
And fantastic.
Yeah, it's been truly eye-opening just to, you know, I knew a few bits about you before, but just really drilling down into some of the phases of your life and how that's, you know, influenced the way you think and the passions that you have, it's been incredible. So thank you for sharing.
Well, thank you. I really honor you for creating this space. I wish you massive success. I know you're expanding out with what you're doing. And I'm really grateful and gracious to have an opportunity to come on and share time with you this afternoon.
So that's going to wrap up the episode, guys. If you were inspired by any of today's conversation, then don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. Share this on Instagram as well. Remember that every life has a story and every story has a lesson. So if you manage to take something away from this episode, then your share may just help someone else do the same. Feel free to reach out to me or today's guest on any questions you have. And it goes without saying, I'm always glad to learn from your insights too. With your support, we're helping open up more of the world to what it really means to have an immigrant mindset. So I appreciate you tuning in each week, and I'll see you at the next one.